Hello and welcome to Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling. Dialect is Bristol's first podcast, set up with a grant from the Scarman Trust in 2002 and goes out every Monday morning at 11 a.m. here on BCFM 93.2. This week we haven't heard from Maurice Kirk for a while. I'm afraid his liberty has been taken away. He's in jail in Wales. But we speak to his sister, Celia Jern, all about how Maurice is. Dialect's produced by volunteers. If you want to join in, contact Volunteering Bristol, who are just off Queen's Square on 0117 989 7733. And I'll repeat those details at the end of the show. So we start this week with Celia Jern, who's the sister of Maurice Kirk. Now, Maurice has been on this programme over the last couple of years several times, but we haven't heard from him recently. I've put a few calls into him without any success. Celia, how is Maurice? And can you just give us an introduction as to why he's now in jail?
Well, you may well ask. We're all wondering why he's in jail. He has been fighting his cause in the civil courts. He's suing the South Wales police, and it's just getting to the end where the judge has asked for final submissions, which was probably the summer of last year, and he had written most of it on his laptop. The police swooped, stole his laptop, threw him in prison for
Sorry to interrupt you, but where was Maurice when all this took place, though?
In Cardiff, because he had to attend the civil court in Cardiff.
So he was in the middle of preparing his case when the police actually arrived and took his laptop. Why did they take his laptop? Because that's obviously privileged information, because he's using it as part of a court case. I find it very surprising that they've got access to what is effectively privileged legal material.
Well, that's the situation he's in. I cannot actually recall why they arrested him for this time, because they keep arresting him and throwing him into prison, and he has to wait for the court case to appear. He's never allowed bail, and when eventually the court case is brought to court and he's produced, they then drop all charges and he's let out with no compensation. And this has been happening for the last 3 or 4 years, really, since he started his civil action against the police for harassment over the last 22 years.
So what's the crux of his problem? I mean, when he was on here, he was saying that he kept getting stopped, for example, by the police over there and asked to produce his documents day after day after day.
Absolutely. Well, I'm not quite sure where their motivation came from, but certainly one of the first things was that when he had his veterinary surgery in Barry, he had trouble with his tenants, and it turned out that the tenant was in fact a daughter of a South Wales police superintendent. But he then discovered that her boyfriend was a convicted drug dealer, and she also was a drug addict. Well, of course, he didn't want them anywhere near his veterinary surgery because of his pharmacy. He felt it was at risk of being robbed with tenants such as these, and they lived upstairs from the surgery. So he got them removed. And since then, he'd had regular harassment from the local police, the Barry police.
Okay. The problem has been really a sort of middle of a battle going on between Maurice and the police. I suppose the lesson is, that the police can actually use all sorts of tactics to actually win a case. But why is he now actually in jail?
Well, he was in prison from last September, October. He went to the police to ask them. The court had asked him to attend a psychiatric test in Bristol, but at the same time another court had put him down for an appearance at the court. He wasn't allowed in the courthouse administrative offices to explain what was he to do, to obey one judge or to appear in court in another on another case. And he asked he phoned them up and asked them, and he couldn't get an answer. And so he went down to the police station and they arrested him. He said some silly thing over the phone to to the control room in his frustration at not getting an answer. What should he do? Go to Bristol for his psychiatric test or go to the, or turn up at the court? He wasn't allowed in the building to explain. He wasn't allowed to, they wouldn't take any phone calls from him. The court wouldn't, the court administration wouldn't allow him to speak to them. So that's why he resorted to asking the police. Rather a silly thing to do, I suspect, but that's what he did. They put him in, they arrested him, and since then he's been in prison. They then he was beaten up in prison. He demanded to see his passport that they held. They denied they had the passport, and then there was a he did a citizen's arrest on a prison officer, and with that, that caused another case, court case. He defends himself totally. And therefore was denied all access to evidence. And he chose to do a citizen's arrest on the prison officer who refused to present him with his passport in the sight of five CCTV cameras. But when it came to court, none of these, surprisingly, were operating. So there was no evidence of how he arrested this man, and so he was accused of assault by holding the man's shoulder.
Okay, and is that what he's actually having? Because I mean, he's been in jail now for a year. I mean, it's certainly not the offence. Certainly, I imagine, is not phoning up a police station and asking whether you should attend court or go to a psychiatric session. That is not an offence which is imprisonable for a year, surely.
No. But in the process of his frustration, he used the words, "Do I have to burn a doctor's house down to get your attention?" Unfortunately, the police saw this as a representing a member of the public, but he had been had a restraining order on for not to harass. He didn't say who it was, which house he was going to burn down, because he wouldn't know which house this particular person lived in.
That's not the wisest sort of thing to do, is it?
It's not the wisest thing to do, but I can imagine in his frustration he was trying to get an answer from the police to what he had to do in 2 days' time, turn up to the court or go travel from Cardiff to Bristol to attend a medical appointment. Anyway, it's quite ridiculous. But he then was given parole, or supposed parole, back in the beginning of July. And at this stage, the civil court judge had written to Cardiff Prison and asked them to provide Morris with his legal paperwork for his civil case, plus a laptop and printing facilities, so that he could get on and finish his final submission, so that he could then write his judgment and finish the case. Well, from November, when the prison received this ask from the civil court, nothing happened until, believe it or not, the beginning of June, when drip by drip the papers arrived. He had managed to get access half an hour a day, I think it was. And then he got the use of a laptop, but he wasn't allowed to put anything on a memory stick or anything like that. This had to be printed off, and anyway, things were just beginning to work his way in that he had this access, when lo and behold, they offer him parole. So they then don't tell him, they stick him in a van, drive him up to Swansea, and he stays in a hostel in Swansea with the most draconian conditions, such as to report hourly to the hostel.
Now, I think this is the point of time which I just randomly put a call into Morris, and I managed to speak to him for a couple of minutes, and he said that, well, I am actually allowed to speak to people, I think it was, he said something like half an hour a week. Maybe that was at that point when he was in this hostel.
I don't know. I think he had free access to his phones, but I don't know, to his mobile phone.
So what were the conditions at the hostel then?
Well, he was allowed out, but every hour he had to come back in and sign in. But unfortunately, his documents had left the prison and had been put in a lock-up or a storage unit 20 minutes away from the hostel by car. Well, of course, he didn't have a car. And, of course, there was no public transport to get him there, because while I went to visit him and drove him in a car, in a hire car, I drove him out there. He ran in, took a photograph of the, of his documents piled high and all higgledy-piggledy, because he'd spent a lot of time sorting them all out at the prison. I had to rush in and say, come on, Morris, you've got to go back because your hour's up. So we then got him back in time to sign in. This happened. He also, while he was out, he was out for a week. He said to me, I will be picked up in the next 2 days, I bet. And sure enough, he was. But he did manage to get to a doctor's surgery. And because he's been suffering terrible gastric pain in the middle of the night. And he wanted, and with his medical knowledge, being a veterinary surgeon, he wanted to know what it was. And of course, he was thinking the worst, that it was probably cancer. He still, but this investigation has been delayed and delayed and delayed by the prison up until that time. And he thought, good, I've got a date in the hospital, which was the following Thursday, I think, or the following Wednesday. But that, I spoke to him, I was with him on the Thursday previous to that. By the Friday, he was arrested again because it was reported that he'd been behaving aggressively at the doctor's surgery. When I phoned the doctor's surgery, which was the only one that took people from this particular hostel, they said the doctor said he knew nothing about it and nobody had complained to him. His reception staff hadn't complained to him. And it turns out there's absolutely no evidence that this was the case. But because the hostel thought it happened, they got an ex-Caswell Clinic nurse to come down and interview him. And she obviously read the medical report, which you've probably heard about in the past, that was totally incorrect and said he had, psychiatric deficit disorder, and that he had a brain tumour. Well, she read all this report, his medical report from the Caswell Clinic, and decided that, in fact, now, because he's coming up for 70, that he had dementia and was a dangerous person to himself and to those in authority and was not safe to be left outside in the outside community. So they threw him into Swansea prison this time. Habeas corpus? I don't know. And, of course, his legal papers have not followed him. And, in fact, he has now got use of a laptop, but absolutely no way of printing anything out. He's got 3 weeks of letters and paperwork to be printed because he has the most appalling writing, and no way of getting it printed off, which is appalling. He's having no medical attention. They deny that they know anything about his complaints. And it's just, you know, nothing's being done.
Surely, whichever jail he's in, whether it's Swansea or Cardiff, there must be doctors in there. There must be decent medical treatment and attention given to sick inmates.
There are doctors in there. Is it decent treatment? I'm not sure, by ignoring people. And of course, when it comes to dishing out painkillers, and I don't know in Swansea whether he gets painkillers. In Cardiff, he was getting painkillers when all the drug addicts lined up for their fix. So that was 8 o'clock in the morning and 4 o'clock in the afternoon. Unfortunately, Morris's pain is at night. And he even tries not to eat, so that if he wants a good night's sleep, he doesn't eat that day, so he doesn't get the gut ache. Because he's never allowed to have any painkillers with him in the and I can understand in a way that, but no one is prepared to be on duty to give him pills if he calls in the middle of the night for them.
Well, Celia, you're a long way away in the Channel Islands. How have you found getting access to Morris and being able to visit him over the last year or so?
Oh, really terrible. Of course, if I put in the right application to the prison and the prison has his say-so, I can visit, and I have visited him. That's why when he was out, I rushed over straight away because I thought, actually, I can have a proper conversation with people not listening and actually get to the bottom of everything and try and help him as best I could in the hours that he was allowed out. And with me, with a car, it meant that I could take him out for a cup of tea, you know, in the town, and he could have a cake, you know, choose his cake before he had to go back for to be signed on again. I mean, it was draconian beyond belief, but he did stick to it. He never missed and the only time they said he'd missed his hourly sign-on was when he was in the hostel for hours working on his paperwork, and then they accused him of not signing in every hour. He said, but you knew I hadn't left, you know, because the documentation was there, that he was still sitting in his room in the... Anyway,
so how have you managed to make it over from the Channel Islands? You have to fly over or get
the boat or something?
I would have
to fly over, hire a car and get there and stay overnight to make it worthwhile, really, because, you know, it's always middle of the day and by that time you've missed your return flight.
And has Morris had many other visitors? Has he, you know, been able to get support from elsewhere outside jail?
He has. Well, of course, when you're a convicted prisoner, you're not allowed that many visits per month, but he has had the requisite visits, but not enough, of course. But the worst thing was, of course, that he didn't have any phone calls. He was denied all making any phone calls. He has no money apart from the pittance they provide each week, and he's only allowed to buy second class stamps. So his handwritten letters get sent out on a very slow basis. He's at last actually got glasses. I arranged glasses to be delivered to him so he could see what he was doing. It's an absolutely appalling situation in Swansea, but he says what it is. The prisons throughout England, probably, but certainly in Wales, are run by three unions. And, you know, they all fight each other. And so the prisoner is the last concern of any of the prison officers. Well, there are some. There are one or two people who are there and have a bit of heart, shall we say.
Well, I mean, one of the press reports that's been coming out over the last couple of years is that we've never seen such a decline in standards in our prisons since this present coalition government, who seem to be deliberately running them down. I mean, I personally know of several people who have worked in the prison service and have left over the last couple of years who just don't believe it's a safe place to work anymore.
No, and it's not safe for anybody. Morris keeps himself into it. Luckily, I think he's probably got a cell to himself. He's not said anything else. He's probably safer than most. But of course, he's an old man. I mean, most people there are under 30 and he's almost 70. So, and I think he's in a wheelchair at the moment, because of his, ankle problems. And the fact that this stomach or whatever it is, intestinal problem that he's got, means he's lost 20 kilos since he's been in Swansea, which is 2 months. I mean, it's frightening, absolutely frightening. He did go to the hospital for a colonoscopy, I think the beginning of August. And he said to the doctors, you do know about my Caswell Clinic medical report, because in fact he'd sent it to them before when he was out, knowing he was going to be seeing them at some time. And the medical staff said, no, we don't know anything about this. Well, we can't operate on you without seeing this report. If it says you've got a brain tumour and et cetera, we can't go ahead. Now they're claiming that he refused to sign for the operation, to allow the operation to go ahead. It was an elective operation and investigation, in fact. And so the prison doctors, the latest rumour, he says, is that they're going to deny him any access to the hospital for this particular procedure, because he's already told the doctors he doesn't want it, Well, of course, he's screaming for it. It's just that he wants them to know everything that there should be to know, and he wants them to investigate this medical report because it's incorrect.
Sounds like, on the medical side anyway, some sort of hideous Kafkaesque bureaucracy that Morris is having to deal with. But what about this cat and mouse game the police seem to be playing? Just as he's about to complete taking a civil case against the police, is cat and mouse the right way to describe it, do you think?
I'm not sure. Yeah, I suppose it absolutely is. I was just trying to think lion and mouse, really, because, I mean, they've got all the trump cards because they just have to nod and a wink at their friends in court and their drinking mates down the pub. And Morris gets beaten up in the prison. He gets denied any rights at all. He gets put on whatever it's called when he's not allowed out and he's not allowed to make phone calls. I mean, currently he has no money to make phone calls. So I didn't hear from him for over six weeks, and he's just started to phone me, and he tells me I'm the only person he's allowed to phone. He's not allowed to phone any of his other supporters or anybody else. It's a huge burden on me because I'm so far away, of course, but then, you know, he is my brother, and I just feel that this has got to, he's got to have somebody standing beside him.
Who's reasonably well-educated yourself, as Morris is, what have you got to say about the way that he's been treated in Britain today? Because it doesn't sound to me like justice.
Certainly doesn't. And I've just written a little piece here that says, will no one listen to this man with a real grievance? Will no one look into the link between the ex-Caswell director and the police? Will no one in the prison service carry out the request of the civil court judge who has seen the evidence of harassment that my brother has suffered? Will no one see to it that a corrupt medical report which has caused loss of family, years of unnecessary pain, loss of his flying license, loss of his wealth and health, is expunged from his medical notes? And shame on all those in authority in Wales for this disgraceful state of affairs. Many hoped Morris Kirk would just disappear off the map and take his story of unearthing corruption in South Wales with him. But this is not going to happen.
So, Celia, what corruption has he unearthed other than the problems that he's had himself with the South Wales police?
Well, the link between the police and the Caswell director, that he has evidence of that.
Just explain that again for us, would you?
Well, the Caswell director was the one who wrote a medical report, having never actually physically examined him, and of course he was a psychiatrist, and stated that Morris had a brain, told a bail judge back in December 2009, that he had a probable brain tumour, and that he, you know, wasn't fit to plead because he had the psychiatric deficit disorder, which of course is a catch-all diagnosis for someone who's eccentric.
So is a psychiatrist actually qualified to diagnose a brain tumour?
Absolutely not. So where he got that from is unbelievable. Morris, actually, as soon as he was released after winning his fictitious machine gun case, as it's called, in February 2010.
Yeah, we better explain that for people that haven't heard about this before, because we had Morris tell us about this himself, and that was that he had a machine gun on an aeroplane which didn't work, which was really rusty, and he was charged for possession of a machine gun.
Yes, he was. The gun had been sold 2 years earlier, in fact, to the person who bought the aeroplane, because it was part of, it balanced the aeroplane. You couldn't fly it's a mock-up of a World War One aeroplane, an Airco DH-2, which Morris had flown at air shows, including the Farnborough air show, because it portrayed the history of the fighter plane, because the front-mounted gun was used in battle, but it didn't shoot the propeller off because the propeller was fixed behind the cockpit. The other system where you had a synchronized propeller and gun was a later invention. And this particular mock-up, he owned it, but then sold it on and sold the gun on as well. And 2 years later, the police accused him of having an illegal weapon, unlicensed and illegal, which, because of 7/7 and terrorist activities, was carrying a minimum 5-year jail sentence.
So how many times has Morris been either wrongly arrested, which itself is quite a serious offence, and he should be, of course, be compensated for that, and then also failed to receive justice in the courts over the years? I mean, it must be
it's
scores.
17 times he's been in prison. 17 times. And usually held until the court case is being called to court, and then mysteriously everything's dropped. The police back out, so because they just keep him in prison that long, and because he doesn't use lawyers, the court won't then listen to his compensation pleas. But this is South Wales for you.
Is there any redress, do you think, for this litany of horrors that's been poured out upon Morris?
Well, I think he'd like to get the civil case over with, because he's been showing, well, I don't know how the judge is going to judge it, so I can't really say, but he was, you know, able to try and sue the police. If the judge decides otherwise, well, the judge decides otherwise, and he loses. Well, he's got nothing else to lose now, because he's lost pretty well everything. So however much the CPS want to sue him for money, he won't have any.
So how much and what has Morris lost over the years?
I don't know. He still has a little bit, but he isn't bankrupt, because of course they're desperate to make him bankrupt, because then you can't sue anybody if you're bankrupt. It's not possible. The court won't hear you if you're bankrupt. So that was one of the strategies of the police, was to make him bankrupt by retaining, taking him to, putting him in prison. So that, and then also, of course, they removed his professional license, but by accusing him. In fact, what happened was that the police called him to a case where a dog was found on the beach, and he then discovered that several other vets had been asked to attend by the police, and they refused to go because they knew they wouldn't get paid. So this injured dog, Morris went to find him and found a group of people around this dog. He could see, actually, it was a mangy old dog that had been probably kicked off the cliff edge in the hope that it would drown in the sea. But the dog survived, and somebody found this dog on the beach. He picked it up and carried it back to his car and took it back to his surgery so he could properly examine it and do whatever it was they needed for the animal to recover, if possible. But someone reported him to his professional body, which is the Royal College of Veterinary Surgeons, with its Royal Charter of Protection. And his name came to the attention of his colleagues, and the South Wales Police submitted evidence to the Royal Court of the number of times he'd been arrested and charged. They didn't mention that most of the charges were not proved or were dropped from lack of evidence, and had nothing to do, of course, with his ability of being a vet. In fact, he was held in high esteem for his operating abilities and as a vet. But that didn't stop the college from taking his license away for a short time. But then Morris went off flying instead, and you know he did that fantastic. I mean, he was an ace aviator, because he flew his antique Piper Cub around the world, reaching Australia, then Japan, and USA and Cuba. And he did that to try and escape from the South Wales Police's vindictive behaviour. But as we know, it was not to last.
Do you think if he'd have been in another part of the country, not South Wales, with this sort of feud going on with the South Wales superintendents and senior hierarchy, it seems, that he would have had an easier ride?
I think he certainly would have done, yes. Oh, absolutely. And it's, I mean, he he begs to have his court cases heard out of Wales because he knows he's more likely to get justice.
And what is it about Wales? Is it just a vendetta going on between Morris and the South Wales Police? Is there anything else that might be causing the South Wales Police to victimise Morris?
I have no idea. I don't like to say that he comes from possibly the wrong side of the Bristol Channel, because you're not, you know, the racist card can't be played by people like Morris. But he knows jolly well if he was of a different hue, he would not be in the state he's in. So the kind of harassment that we know has happened in the past to folk in the London area, such as we've heard through the Lawrence situation, etc., Stephen Lawrence situation, he would have been helped along the way, not kicked in every direction by everybody.
What about MPs? Have they been able to help at all?
Actually, his own MP, Alan Cairns, has worked very well for Morris. But, of course, they've only got so much time to devote to each person who's demanding. And I should imagine, because he is an MP for a Welsh constituency, he's got quite a lot of people complaining to him about this, that and the other. And he has been pretty good, I have to say. But he hasn't managed to stop this horrible vindictive behaviour that a lot of it is organised in the local pub. It's coming from the low life, but it's obviously also being started by people further up the chain, and Morris would obviously mention the Masonic situation. I don't know if he's got any proof of that, but it's old boy network, or whatever it is you like to call it, is being involved, and they just want to get rid of Morris because he's managed to have all sorts. And he, to be fair to me, he hasn't told me everything that he knows, because you know we can only talk on a public line, which is being listened to. Of course, every word he says on the telephone is being listened to. All his letters he writes and the letters we write to him get passed via an outside agency before it comes into him at the prison. So it's we know that's happening. So he can't be he can't reveal all his cards, and he won't.
So what's the situation now, Celia? When is he due out?
Well, the probation officer says he's not due out till, I think it's the 22nd or 3rd of March of next year, which is totally ridiculous. He's also still a mapper on the mapper list, which means multi-agency public protection arrangement. And he was a level 3. I think he's been told he's a level 2 now, but he hasn't done anything that remotely puts him in on the mapper list at all.
Well, so what you're saying is actually he's a kind of a terrorist, a threat to the public.
Yes, oh yes. But what he is, of course, is a threat to certain people in high places. And that's the truth of it.
So the people at the top of South Wales Police, do you think they've really got anything to fear from Morris and his civil court case against them?
Well, I think there's been quite a few cases recently of injustices being exposed in the South Wales police force, wrongful arrests, people being in prison for years and then being found in that vital evidence has been hidden from the court, which of course is something Morris has been suffering. He hasn't been allowed to see the evidence when he's been defending himself. His latest, the latest case, as I mentioned earlier, was that he wasn't allowed to see see video or listen to audio tapes of interviews or to see videotapes of CCTV to prove that the story that the police were giving the CPS were incorrect. He didn't have a chance to defend himself because he didn't have the prison wouldn't allow him the facilities to look at any of this evidence all very well sending the judge saying, well, I order the CPS to send you a copy of that video or that tape, audio tape, when he's got no facilities on which to see or hear the stuff. I mean, it's and then when he comes to court, he says to the judge, oh, but you've had the opportunity to see it. But of course, they don't hear that. You know, the judges have no idea what's happening inside their prisons, quite clearly. It would do good for the judges of the courts that send people to prison not to go round a prison when all the inmates are having lunch or out working in the fields or whatever it is they're doing within the walls, out on the playground or what they call it, the courtyard, walking round, but to actually go and be, visit without prison officers listening and building up rapport with some of these prisoners so they can actually hear what really, really happens in our prisons. Because I think they will be shocked. And, of course, the situation is getting worse and worse. As you've mentioned, the quality of the staff now, the prison numbers have risen hugely, and the quality of the staff has plummeted because they can only get ex-squaddies in there who have been brutalized by the Iraqi-Afghanistan wars. So, of course, they treat them as if they're the enemy. Not fun.
Talking to police here in Bristol, one of the things I get regularly here from them is that our prisons are starting to fill up with people who have mental problems. Now, I don't really want to accuse Morris of that, but he's certainly eccentric. I mean, would you say that may be a factor here, that he needs is a bit of help and treatment in that direction, or is that a wrong accusation about Morris? Because there's certainly, if you talk to the police, they'll say what we're having to deal with is a lot of people who have got mental problems and mental difficulties of one sort or another.
Oh, I'm sure. I mean, I don't know if you know, but I was a magistrate in the juvenile court over here, which is a very small jurisdiction, and we were very well aware that the prison was full of people who couldn't cope with life, basically, and of course they end up in prison, and actually they quite like being in prison because they're fed and watered and looked after to a certain degree, but of course now they're not because, you know, it's a dangerous place, not necessarily the prison here, but certainly from the conditions I understand in South Wales, they are dangerous prisons. And as far as Morris is concerned, I think he needs somebody to listen to him. That's what he needs. He needs somebody in authority to listen. And I think the civil case was extremely helpful to him because he was able to cross-examine the witnesses and actually show up. You see, he's got witnesses who who've said in that civil case that I don't know if I'm allowed to say it on the open air, but just this man would say it again on the airwaves, that he was lent on extremely heavily by certain members of the police force to change his witness statement to do with the machine gun case, and he didn't say it at the time, but afterwards he was. He was quite prepared to do that, and he never really liked Morris, this particular witness. He was suddenly realised that how corrupt the police can be at either not presenting all the evidence, being very cherry-picking of evidence that's available, and if any evidence comes to light that doesn't go their way, they have been known to lean on the witness, and this particular witness was lent on to try and make Morris's situation with the machine gun case worse. But luckily, the jury, after the second day, decided that the police were lying all the way through. And I can tell you, when you watch them running up and down outside the courtroom, whispering to each other and listening to the evidence and coming out and whispering to the next of their witnesses what to say, what to do, I mean, it was ridiculous. That sort of thing shouldn't be allowed to happen. But, of course, it did, and I can swear to that is what happened because I was there.
And yeah, there's also this thing that took place in the United States, the Stanford Prison Experiment, which showed that without the right kinds of controls, that prisons can become extremely cruel places. And I wonder whether you think that that's what Morris is having to deal with now.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And remember, a lot of these young people in there, drug addicts, recovering, you know, they're denied the fix they really want. And they're all scared. And when you're scared, you can be really vicious. And those who aren't scared then rule the roost. So, you know, it's a horrific place. Morris is an eccentric. He isn't your average run-of-the-mill person. But one of his main problems is he's too bright. And he can see through people rather blinkeredly. He doesn't necessarily see the whole picture, but he gets a bit obsessed with what he can see in front of him. And he's determined to get the truth out. He wants the truth out. He wants to expose those who have ill-treated him and caused this huge harassment of him. He doesn't want to say every member of the South Wales Police are corrupt. Absolutely not. He said there's some good guys, some guys who actually leave the service because they can't stand the stink. And this is the problem. The good guys go. The whistleblowers can't afford to be whistleblowers. They just leave. It is a cowardly thing, but Morris is not a coward. He's prepared to fight on behalf of lots of other people who've suffered under this regime. And, of course, they want him dead. That's partly why the medical situation is so bad. They keep refusing him, changing his dates, delaying his vital medical examinations. It's not really the doctors in the hospitals, it's the system, and people get leaned on.
Yes, very Kafkaesque. Anyway, Celia Jern, thanks very much for joining us, and our hopes and prayers are with Morris for his speedy release. And certainly with all my encounters of him, he's absolutely no danger to the public whatsoever.
Thank you very much, Tony. I will hope to report it, what you said. Thank
okay.
you.
Okay, and do keep us informed as to what's going on. Hopefully we'll see if we can even get a phone call with Morris in the next
few
months.
That won't be
months.
Allowed. That certainly won't be allowed. He's only allowed to phone me, and you can probably talk to him at the end of March if he hasn't been picked up again by some nonsense or other. Publicity is what he needs.
Okay, Celia. Well, we're doing our bit here at Bristol Community Radio, and thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk.
And over the last few weeks, we've been looking at some Christian issues to do with the Bible, with Kent Hovind. This week, though, it's Rupert Murdoch. Yes, believe it or not, Rupert Murdoch owns the copyright to the Bible. Would you believe that? If you want to use more than 200 words of the New International Version, which is one of the most recent translations of the Bible, you've got to get the permission of his Rupertness. Now, there's a series of interviews online, which used to be distributed by VHS Video many years ago, called The Prophecy Club. Some fascinating interviews there, and the sort of stuff that you will never see. Oh, well, you certainly don't see on mainstream TV over here, with some really interesting ideas. I wouldn't necessarily vouch for all the things that are said, but certainly it gets the old brain cells going. So it's the New International Version of the Bible is the subject matter of this Prophecy Club talk. The speaker is Gail Riplinger, and you can find it online. It's under the title New Age Bible Versions. So what she's essentially saying is the New International Version of the Bible, which you'll find in almost all Church of England churches and many others too, is actually a mistranslation of the Bible. And if you really want to get a decent translation from the Greek, from the original Greek, back 2,000 years ago, you need to go and get a King James Version of the Bible, which was translated in the 1600s. Apparently, it's far, far better than the one that Rupert Murdoch has, a New International Version, the most recent one. So anyway, hand over to Gail Riplinger now, who has a few caustic words for Rupert Murdoch.
Jesus said, go into all the world and preach the gospel. Just don't use more than 200 words. Okay? Now, he didn't really say that. But can you imagine going into a foreign country or going to Canada or going someplace? You've used 200 words, and you've got to get copyright permission from someone to use any more. Because all of the new versions are copywritten. And the copyright law says that anytime you use more than 200 words, and it will say this in the front of many of these editions. In fact, I know of a number of lawsuits. The New American Standard was guilty of suing some missionaries in the Far East. They're not actually suing them, but harassing them, I should say, until they would quit using more than 200 words. And so if we can only use 200 words without getting permission for these new versions, who are we going to go to? Okay, who has the power to give us permission to use more than 200 words? Okay, we've got a picture of Brother Bill here, Mr. Greenspan of the Federal Reserve, and Rupert Murdoch. Okay, this came from a national news magazine. It was either Time or Newsweek. They considered these three men the most powerful men in the world. To get permission to use more than 200 words of the NIV, we're going to have to go to this man, Rupert Murdoch. He bought the exclusive printing rights to the New International Version. Why would he do that? Why would he be interested in doing something like that? Now, Mike Royko is a columnist for the Chicago Tribune, and he referred to Rupert Murdoch as, and I'm quoting here because I would never call anyone this, he called him a scumbag, and he also called him the Prince of Darkness. Now, there's a book out called Murdoch. It's by a gentleman named Shawcross, and it talks about Mr. Murdoch's plan to control the world, all right? And it shows some of the newspapers and some of the tabloids that he owns, and I wanted to put transparencies up, but quite frankly, they were so rude and crude and horrible that I really didn't feel that I could put them up for anyone to see. But the newspaper that he owned in England was called The Sun, and when he took that over, he turned it 10 times worse than the National Mirror, and it had photos of nude women all through it and all this sort of thing. Wherever he goes, he just degrades everything, and that's why this unsaved, probably, writer for the Chicago Tribune called him the Prince of Darkness. Now, when he called him the Prince of Darkness, there may be more behind that. This is a photograph that Mr. Murdoch evidently posed for, because, you know, when you're just walking through the office and you're in your conference room, you don't look like this. Okay, you don't have a black table with 13 chairs around it. You don't have red lights on you. You don't have your hands holding the whole globe. Okay, this picture was obviously posed. Okay, now as a Christian, would you pose behind a black table with 13 chairs holding the globe like this with red lights on you? I don't think that you would. And so there's a reason why he called him the Prince of Darkness. Every time Mr. Murdoch poses for pictures, he tries to look spooky. I think he might be spooky, I don't know. But anyway, Mr. Murdoch owns Fox Broadcasting, 20th Century Fox movies, and he's the producer of Bart Simpson. Okay, so those of you who have NIV Bibles, I call them the Bart Simpson Bible, because if you want permission to take 20 minutes out of a Bart Simpson segment, you've got to write to Rupert, and if you want to take more than 200 words from the NIV, you've got to write to Rupert Murdoch. Okay. Now, the editor of the New International Version, the chief editor, has some heretical views about how someone is saved. And so even if we could go into all the world and use an NIV, I don't think anyone would necessarily get saved easily. And here's why. This is what Edwin Palmer said, who's the chief editor of the NIV. He said, "This shows the great error that's so prevalent today in some Orthodox Protestant circles. And that, namely the error that regeneration, that's being born again, depends upon faith, and that in order to be born again, one must first accept Jesus as Savior." Now he's calling this a great error prevalent in Orthodox Protestant circles. Well, now that isn't an error, that's the gospel, okay? But it isn't the gospel in the NIV, okay? We have another gospel there. Corinthians says, "If he that cometh preacheth another gospel." The King James says, "Children, how hard it is for them that trust in riches to enter into the kingdom of God." Okay, the new versions say, "Children, how hard it is to enter into the kingdom of God." Can you imagine handing a little child a Bible that said, "Children, how hard it is to enter into the kingdom of God"? That's the last thing one would want to do, because it's easy. to be saved. One merely needs to believe on the Lord Jesus Christ and thou shalt be saved. Okay? So the gospel is a different gospel there.
That was Gail Ripplinger from the Prophecy Club, as a series of lectures you'll find online. And that was New Age Bible Versions. That's the title of you'll find online. And the author, Gail Ripplinger, has also written a book on the same subject about the New International Version of the Bible. She thoroughly recommends you maybe give it to a second-hand bookseller and get yourself a decent translation, like the King James Version, translated in Britain back in the 1600s.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk.
And to finish this week, it's another Christian piece, and this time it's from a preacher called Barry Smith. Barry Smith is from New Zealand. He died between 8 and 10 years ago, but he was an extremely popular, charismatic preacher who really shot from the hip. He also went around the South Pacific Islands talking to people there, and he was extremely popular. He's one of those preachers that speaks very, very directly rather than uses mealy-mouthed attempts to persuade people to listen to him. Anyway, this time it's talking about Jesus's brothers and sisters, and it's amazing how much the Bible actually says about Jesus's brothers and sisters that you won't hear in the Church of England or the normal churches today. Let's hope that they do get a little bit more educated. So here now, Barry Smith.
She had at least six other children beside Jesus. Mary had six other children besides Jesus. You say, what? Is that in the Bible? Yes. Let's turn to Matthew chapter 13, please. Most Christians I've spoken to don't know this. No one's ever told them. Is there anybody here tonight comes from a small town or a village? And you will agree with me that when something exciting happens in your village, everybody goes to have a look at it. If there's a fire down the road, does everybody follow the fire engine? If Mr. Brown is bashing up Mrs. Brown, does everybody go to have a look? Yes. How much more did the people know all the details of what went on when Jesus and Mary and Joseph lived in town? Let's see what they said. Let's read together in Matthew 13, verse 55. Is not this the carpenter's son? Is not his mother called Mary, and his brethren are called James, next one, Joseph, next one, Simon, next one, Judas. She had at least six other children besides Jesus, and here are the names of four of them. You said there's supposed to be six, but I've only mentioned four here. I know, but we haven't finished reading yet. We're now going to read verse 56. Here we go. And his sisters, plural, are they not all with us? And so we see that not only did Mary have four boys, she had more than one girl. Do we know the names of the girls? We know the name of one. So we turn to the book of Mark, chapter 15. Let's turn to Mark 15 tonight, shall we? If I can read it, everybody can read it. Read with me, please. Here's Jesus hanging on the cross. And you'll see there in verse 40 altogether. This is Mark 15 and verse 40. There were also women looking on afar off, among whom was Mary Magdalene, look at it, and Mary the mother of James the Less, and Joseph, those two are mentioned, and Salome. So the name of one of Jesus' half-sisters was Salome. We don't know the name of the other one. So that means that the Lord Jesus Christ was brought up in a very large family. I find that exciting. But he was brought up in a big family. I can imagine from time to time he worked with his father in the carpenter shop. Can you imagine Joseph saying, sweep under the bench there? He didn't call him Jesus. His name was Yeshua. That's his Hebrew name. His Hebrew name was Yeshua, and that means Savior. And if you put a long A above it, Yeshua, it means salvation. So when Mary called them for dinner at night, she would call out, Yeshua, James, Joseph, Simon, Judas, Salome, bring your young sister and come in for dinner.
That was Barry Smith, the preacher. He died about 8 or 10 years ago, but you can see many of his talks online still. And he's originally from New Zealand, spent a lot of his time going around the Pacific Islands educating or converting or propagandising, some would say, some of the Pacific Islanders. That's all for this week. Dialect's Bristol's first weekly MP3 podcast and is on Bristol Community FM 93.2 at 11 a.m. every Monday morning. If you're online, you can subscribe to our emails or download the podcast from dialectradio.co.uk. Thanks to our guest, Celia Jeune, also to interviewees Gail Ripplinger and Barry Smith. Celia Jeune, of course, is a magistrate from the Channel Islands, a former magistrate. And also to studio engineer Dave Bazanko. Dialect's a Bristol Broadband Co-op production, and anyone can contribute. If you'd like to, contact us through Volunteering Bristol on 0117 989 7733 or at bristolvolunteers.org.uk. That was Dialect, and I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a very good week. Thanks for listening. Till the same time next week. Goodbye for now.